Welcome to the Start Well podcast. I'm Dawn Thomas, your host. As a mother, financial advisor, and researcher, I know the importance of empowering young people on their financial journeys. Whether you're a parent, grandparent, or the coolest aunt or uncle, join me in exploring how impactful conversations about money can shape a young person's future. Let's harness their superpower of time and your superpower of influence to ensure they start well and continue to live well into the future. The information discussed in this podcast is general in nature and does not take into account your personal and financial objectives and situation. Before acting on any information discussed here, you should consider its appropriateness, having regard to your objectives, needs, and financial position. On today's episode of Start Well, we are so lucky to have the author of Shareplicity, Danielle Ekuyye. So, Danielle, sort of give me a little bit of a brief of how to pronounce the name. And Danielle, I'm just hoping that didn't butcher that too badly.
No, Dawn, you did incredibly well, so don't worry about that.
Thank you, Danielle. Danielle, you have written a book that has been come to known as such an important book when someone is learning about their share journey, you know, and it's rated incredibly well on Amazon. You've got a number of 5-star reviews. Just for our listeners, I'm just going to read out a few of them. So just to show how it's impacting lives of your readers. We've got someone saying, as a new investor in the share market based in Australia, I needed more information about the choices that are available to me. The infamous Barefoot Investor book may have started the journey, but it was on the skinny of the details of share investing. Enter this book. It introduces and explains terms exactly in the context needed. Now, that's actually weaved through a few of the reviews that many people are aware of the Barefoot Investor book, and it's had such an influence in Australia. And they liken your book to having that impact on the learnings around investing. How have you had any feedback directly coming through from readers about how you've changed their share knowledge journey?
Oh, I'd love to say yes, but yeah. No. I can only though be very flattered and very proud that it has been compared to sort of a barefoot investing for shares, because it was designed to do that. And I discovered in the process and the journey of writing it, with the help of my publisher, that actually writing about this topic in a way that was easy to understand is actually incredibly complex. And I often compare it to, if you watch a really good tennis player or you watch a really good golfer or any of those people, now I'm not comparing myself to an elite athlete, far from it, but the challenge of writing the book was actually distilling very complex issues, because finance, the numbers, all the stuff behind it is quite complex, but I wanted to present it in a way that anybody could pick it up and hopefully understand.
Yeah, and you know what, you've certainly done that, Danielle, and you know, with those reviews as well, it's showing that it's actually sparked this journey for people to have the confidence to actually go into investing in shares. For our listeners today, if they haven't actually come across your book, today's episode is really about, you know, picking up Shareplicity, and we are going to discuss certain points that adults can actually gain knowledge in, but possibly taking that home and sharing that with their kids. You talk in your book about the 21st century investing. What does that mean, Danielle?
That's really interesting, because it encompasses so many different aspects. The pandemic had quite a material impact on investors globally, and there was almost this push to make it easier for everybody to be able to invest globally across markets into all different sectors and countries that formerly had been quite expensive. Now, the process had been in train for many, many years, but I think everybody sitting at home in lockdown, it precipitated what was called the democratization of investing, which was predominantly in the US, But it entailed the likes of Reddit coming to the market. It entailed a lot of low-cost trading platforms being made available, which was then replicated here in Australia. And it was to bring information that was previously only available to very wealthy people or to big fund managers and institutions like your superannuation funds, to bring it to you personally. So you were able to access information about the biggest companies in the world, the Teslas, the Nvidias, companies like that, Amazon, Alphabet, as well as our own Australian companies, in formats that didn't cost a lot of money. But not only that, there were products and more products made available to allow investors to buy these shares. And they could either buy them directly or they could buy them through other offerings such as exchange-traded funds. So at one level, that's what's happened in the 21st century. I always used to describe it as once upon a time, nobody could afford to buy US shares directly except the billionaires in Australia. But now anybody can. The other aspect of 21st century investing, it's in the last or post really the GFC, you've seen this remarkable resurgence of technology and innovation. Now, it started in 1995 as the internet really took hold and online that we now take for granted was emerging. It culminated in the dot-com bubble and boom in 2000-2001. But the crash in 2008, going into 2009, almost recreated this necessity for businesses to invest in technology. And that is what has captured the markets, predominantly in the US, but also in other parts around the world. And if anything, that's just become a bigger and bigger theme of what we're dealing with as we're in the month of February in 2024.
Yeah, so Danielle, is that what prompted as well that you've got a book, Shaplicity 2, that centers around the US market? Was that kind of feeling that demand to just know more about how people can get exposure to that now that they have access to it?
Totally. I'm just writing, I've just helped out an article that hopefully is coming out on Morningstar about the genesis of that book and why I wrote it. And it was because I wanted to diversify my shares into growth markets, which is the US. And that's why I wanted to write Shareplicity 2, which is a guide to how an investor in the US. The book was probably too soon. It was I'm very forward thinking and sometimes I think far too many years in advance. But what I will say is that it's becoming, I think, probably more of a useful tool because people now in Australia are investing in, well, Tesla became very popular. Now it's Nvidia. They're also buying BYD in China. So as a group of Australian investors are increasingly looking to gain overseas exposure.
Actually, that's what I thought when I was reading your book, Danielle. I'm like, does Danielle, is she able to look into the future? Because when this was written, well, your commentary that you have here is, you know, I'm a financial advisor and our investment committee regularly updates us. And what you're saying here in the book that you wrote in 2020 is still quite relevant or it's unfolded where we are now in 2024. You know, when you wrote that in 2020, because sometimes with what you say in a particular point, especially with the share market, that can change in preceding years of how that outlook might be. How have you felt this book has aged with the times, with the information that's available now?
I haven't actually reread most of it or any of it recently because I've been very busy, but I think if I would go back and look at it, I think what I wrote is really held true about investing in quality companies, investing in companies that can grow their dividends, that generate good cash flow. The company names that I cited in the book, I think they've aged very well. I think I was able to articulate the trends. Clearly, the pandemic had a very material impact on economies. and also companies. And unfortunately, the pandemic literally broke out at the time that the book would have been sent to the publishers. So I put a caveat in that monetary policy would change dramatically, which of course it did. We went to zero interest rates. And of course, we've been adjusting for the last 18 months for all that excess liquidity and money that came into the system. But fundamentally, the way that the book proposes that you invest, the products that are available, the macroeconomic outlooks that I provided, the bones of the book, I think, have really has stood well the test of time. So I'm pretty proud of that.
Yeah, and what's handy in your book as well, Danielle, is that, you know, you've got your key points at the end of the chapter that summarize things actually really easy, that I feel that I could actually take those points and go to my kids, for example, and go, look, these are the key points from the chapter, in a way that doesn't make me, you know, give too much information where it might be lost on someone that is younger. Topic of, you know, fiscal policy versus monetary policy, and then the role of interest rates in shares. How would you describe that in a really simple sense for someone wanting to know how interest rates would affect a share portfolio?
Right. Well, typically higher interest rates feed in two ways. They impact the companies that are represented by the shares. And that is because companies like us, individuals, have debt. We have mortgages, we have borrowings, companies have borrowings. So if the interest rate costs go up, therefore their debt goes up, which means they need to generate more earnings to cover the cost of the interest, or they need to get rid of the borrowings. So higher interest rates materially can impact on companies' earnings capacity. Equally, interest rates impact on a relative basis the value of shares. Put really simply, when you have 0% return by having your money in cash, a term called TINA, there is no alternative, developed during the pandemic, which basically forced investors to look for higher return for their money. So they bought shares. And the more that the interest rates stayed low, the more speculative and frothy the market became. When interest rates go up, suddenly, well, not suddenly, but then we have an alternative, which is to have cash on hand in a bank or private credit by way of example, or fixed, what do you call them, term deposits. And they yield potentially 4%, 5%, 6%. Some corporate debt, corporate bonds are yielding in Australia, good quality ones, around 6% to 7%. So you have an alternative to buying a share to generate a return on your money. So there's a twofold lever of higher interest rates. One is to valuations and the relative performance between asset classes. And the other one is actually on the balance sheet and the earnings capacity of the companies.
Well, thank you for that, Danielle. I think that's it's interest rates are a very hot topic in households, because I think people think of it more of how is it going to impact cash flow for them personally? And I think this is kind of taking it out a bit broader. If you are investing, you're even looking at your share component in your superannuation fund, you're understanding what the impact of these announcements are doing. And definitely quite an important conversation to take back home, because you can kind of relate it to the real thing, right? Like you pay your bills, but there's a broader impact. You know, how does it impact in companies? So yeah, thank you for that. The other concept that I think is a misunderstanding, definitely as a financial advisor, I see when people come in, is this sense of, you know, the panic when the market is going down. And then, you know, we have this graph that we see where people sell out at the bottom, then they try and buy in as it's going up. how do we get people to keep calm and carry on through those times?
Yeah, that is like, I should say now, the $3 trillion question, because billions don't count anymore, do they, Dawn?
Yeah,
it is very hard, and it depends on your age as well. A lot of retirees were very badly hit in the GFC because they didn't sell, or they were too heavily exposed to shares. But one has to put the GSC or major drawdown events where markets fall by more than 30%. They don't happen very often. Markets generally go up more over time than they go down. And I think that's where a good financial advisor comes into place, is to try and calm the nerves down, because humans, with our flight and fight response, that we, you know, that goes back to the old caveman days,
yes,
is very strong. And we hate loss. We feel loss viscerally more than we do when we get the wins. So the wins, when your share portfolio goes up, you can actually feel, and I'm first one to put my hand up, you feel great. When it goes down, it's like sad face, big sad face. What have I done wrong? But if you understand the companies that are underlying the share prices, because the share price is not the company, and this is where people get very confused. The share price is reflective of market sentiment. It's reflective of millions of investors around the world all doing their thing. And they don't all have the same goals, needs, and everything that an individual does. So I think people have to understand, if you understand the company, if you understand that the company is going to exist in 2, 3, 5, you know, 6, 7 years, and nobody has a crystal ball, we can't forecast doom and gloom. So you have to, an investor has to be positive. But if you know the company, you know it has a track record, you know that management can succeed over time and overcome adversity, then you take it back to, okay, the share price is falling, but the world's not going to end. Therefore, try not to panic at the bottom. And Peter Lynch, a very famous investor who ran the Magellan Fund in the 90s, I think he produced almost a compound rate of a 30% return each year. He said, anybody can invest, anybody can crunch the numbers. What people can't do is stomach the volatility. And I often look at my own personal example, because I took control of my money in 2008. And even as a former institutional advisor, it's still a big thing to do, because institutional advisors are sometimes the worst people in the world, Dawn, to manage their own money, a bit like stockbrokers. And I'm more proud of the fact that almost 20 years on, so 16 years on, I'm still going strong, and I've been able to manage my money within the context of everything that's been happening in my own personal life and everything like that. So I would say, if I were to look back on my career and say, what was my biggest success? It's actually me managing my money to achieve long-term growth within the risk parameters. And that has been learning to deal with these massive ups and downs of markets. And it's not easy. I had a US share last night, Palo Alto Networks, which is a cybersecurity company, and it fell 28%. And I go, oh, wow, that wasn't fun. So, but I'm not selling the shares. And at some point, I may actually, once, you know, the market calms down a bit, I may add to it. That's not a recommendation, anyone. Don't go out and run out and buy Palo Alto Networks. But I just wanted to use it as an example, Dawn. So people need to check their emotions at the door and remind themselves, what are their goals? What are they trying to achieve? The world's not going to end, because you can't invest for nuclear holocaust or pandemics, but you can know your companies.
Danielle, I'm actually surprised to say that you even feel that the emotion of feeling a bit down when you see it, seeing the share price go down. So I'm a bit surprised that it's still, like you say, it's a very human thing that we're going to experience that. Oh. Yeah, and just understanding maybe not to act on it in panic, just...
No, I speak to professional investors all the time in my current job, and I get some of them after the interview, if I'm not interviewing somebody else, and they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't own this share, and it's a huge percentage of the index, and oh my gosh, it's so stressful, and blah, blah, blah. Emotions are a massive part, and I think that's why it's so challenging for investors. And the other thing that can be challenging sometimes is differentiating between the numbers versus companies and their culture and what makes a great company. Mm-hmm. But that's probably diving into something that's just a little bit too off the radar.
No, I think that makes sense. I think as the journey grows, right, if our listeners are picking up your book and they're starting their journey, they might get more and more into it where they're actually looking at whether the company's values also match up against their own, because their children, we know that Generation Z is very focused on values and purpose-driven decisions. I'm also just interested as well, Danielle, in your thoughts around that idea of being conservative with investments. You have explained that it's part of who we are as humans with the flight, right response. But women are known to be a bit more conservative with their investing decisions. You know, and I'm thinking about my daughter now, who's about 12. And I think with the time frame she has, she's not going to be too worried about something going up and down. When do you think that actually happens, where we start being at just restricting ourselves from entering journeys like investing in shares because of being apprehensive of that journey?
Good question. One of the reasons why I wanted financial independence was because I saw my mother receiving terrible advice in the early 1970s, and basically she lost a huge amount of money, which had a very material impact on her, which as a young child for me had a very material impact on me. I think that women sometimes to their own disadvantage are too risk averse. You need to take risk in everything. Well, let's face it, Dawn, you walk out the front door and you're taking the risk, aren't you? So, I mean, that's the irony, as opposed to saying, well, I'm going to put my money in some of Australia's best companies and the best companies in the world. And, you know, people get scared about that. I think that, like anything, the comfort levels will grow once you start doing it. You're scared to go swimming because you can't swim. But once you learn to swim, you love swimming. And the thing about investing, it is like anything else. You can read trillions of books, but you actually physically have to get your hands dirty. And even those simulation models of running portfolios, I don't really think personally they're a great idea, because you don't actually feel the loss. In the same way as when your daughter learns to drive and she comes home one day and she goes, oh, Mum, you're not going to believe it, I just had a little ding. And you're like, oh, darling, I'm so sorry, you all right? And it's like, oh, and then you're like, oh, damn, the insurance. Like, for her, there's no consequences. But for you, who has her on your insurance policy, like, there's a whole swathe of consequences. So there's synthetic portfolios, simulated portfolios. You go, oh, gosh, Palo Alto fell 28% last night. What a bummer. But hey-ho, no problems. We'll just throw more money at it. But the point is you're not throwing your money at it. You're throwing, like, imaginary money. So I think the only way for people's comfort levels is to actually, yes, read the books, but actually start to invest and do it slowly and do it in a pace that they're comfortable with, within the confines of what their budgets allow.
So Danielle, in that sense, a lot of people already have a share portfolio by way of superannuation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And superannuation is earmarked for retirement, and we know that has a very long investment time frame, which, you know, does kind of iron out the volatility over that time. So there's that bit of you saying learning with the journey and getting into it. How much should they experiment, I don't know if that's the right way, with their superannuation versus setting up a portfolio on their own and then learning those concepts?
Oh, I couldn't possibly comment on the superannuation thing. It's just not my area. I think it's you don't have to directly invest in shares. You have the option of buying passive ETFs.
Yeah.
Just bear that in mind, which is still actively investing. I don't think there's anything wrong. I mean, it's compulsory superannuation. You have to save. And I think above and beyond that, there is still, hopefully, well, if anybody has any money left over after the cost of living has gone up, but there are ways to continue to invest. And even if it's just, you know, a few dollars a week, you can just put that away into an ETF. And over time, that money will grow in value and compound. And compounding is probably too big a topic to take on here, but there's a very great economist from Canada who always refers to the eighth wonder of the world, which Einstein referred to, which is compounding. And that is letting your money grow in value over time when it grows in value through both income and capital appreciation. And that's why we have superannuation, because we're trying to put money away in the present for the future, and it can deliver long-term returns.
Yeah, I think you definitely addressed that question, Danielle, because sometimes a few people think they have to know this much of information, like they have to know everything they need to know before they make change, as opposed to maybe work with what you already have and, you know, look into a fund that's really invested in a diversified manner and think about, you know, whether that matches up to your risk profile, for example, and take a read of the options. You don't have to go into being an expert straight away. So we're relating it to kids, and I really liked how you highlighted about, I would like to say, I'll call it skin in the game, right? So if they understand the consequence of their actions of doing something around investing, they'll probably learn a bit better rather than imaginary money or money that they feel is not, they're not going to feel the loss. If someone young is starting their journey, you have talked about ETFs in your book. You've also talked about, you know, the age ranges, like we talked about, when you're younger. If they're trying to learn about the share journey, Danielle, would it be focused on going into individual shares and seeing how they operate? So it gives you a chance to read into the company and see those valuations and things like that, or looking more at a diversified kind of strategy? And I know there's no right answer to that, but what are your views on...
I think you've got to keep it really simple. I was speaking to a fund manager, portfolio manager yesterday, who likes a company called Premier Investments, and they own Smiggle. And anyone that has a child will know what Smiggle is. And I told him the story that when my now 23-year-old son was about 8, he dragged me into a Smiggle store in Westfield and, of course, wanted to empty my wallet into everything available at Smiggle. I took one look at the store and thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I'd love to invest in it. Okay, silly me at the time didn't realize Premier Investments, the listed company, owns Smiggle, right? I could have bought Premier Investments back then and it would have been an amazing compounder over time, because of course they are benefiting from the likes of Smiggle, but also Peter Alexander and all their other brands that they have. Equally, if you have a young daughter, now Dawn, this will be right down your strata, you've probably been dragged into Lovisa.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, Lovisa is listed. I would keep it as simple as, if they love the products, they love the experience. It's not every company that you can do this with, but it's a lot easier than saying, you know, oh, I really love iron ore, I think I'll buy some BHP, or I love going to the Commonwealth Bank, I really must get exposure to the Australian housing market and the mortgage market. I mean, that's an easy way to get a tangible feel for children. Even like Rebel Sports, that's represented in Super Retail, if my memory serves me correctly. So even via retailers, there is a good way. Or alternatively, lots of young boys probably think, wow, I want a Tesla or I want a Ferrari. Well, you can actually buy a Ferrari share and they're incredibly good performers. Or somebody might say, well, I just love a Louis Vuitton. Well, guess what? LVMH is listed as well. So Peter Lynch, again, to go back to him, there is a school of thought out there that you buy these companies that have very strong competitive advantages, that if you love the products, then the rest of the people will and the earnings will come. It's not always that simple. But the one thing I want to pick you up on is this expert thing. Far too many people in finance think they know everything. think that they always know everything. Most of the time, we know nothing, because you can't know everything, because it goes back to all the different things that are going on in markets. And I say to people, the best investors, like Warren Buffett, they do it because they love it. They don't do it to make money. He does it because he likes the intellectual rigor of reading and learning about the companies. The money is the byproduct, but that's not his primary objective. And I think this is where people get confused. If you have too much hubris and you're not, like, when you look at Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett, they were very modest men, modest in the way they lived, modest in the way that they came across, because they realized that part of their success has been luck being there at the right time, and equally luck that they have changed the way that they invest over time, because investing is not static, it's a changing world, and you have to change as it goes on. So I would always say, take the term expert with a big pinch of salt. Of course, there are financial advisors such as yourself, and you are accredited and you have to do all the research and learn all about it. That's different, though, to being, I'm an expert and I know everything. So I always say that share investing is it's got so many shades of grey, and people try and make it very black and white, but the shades of grey are where it, I think, humbles most people.
Oh, thank you for that, Danielle. And I think that expert feel is what stops people from getting into things. Before they can even start, they've talked themselves out of it because they are trying to reach an impossible standard. Or like you said, it doesn't actually exist.
Exactly.
And yeah, that view of talking to your children about the companies and, hey, just let's look at the company. If you really love it that much, you know, that could be something you invest in. That would be a fantastic way. In fact, Danielle, I'm going to share that with the kids tonight. I'm going to ask them, if you could invest in any company, what's it going to be? And then we'll take a look and assess what comes out of that conversation.
Yeah, because a lot of, I see this guy on Twitter and he goes, oh, he asked his son, so what three shares would you buy? And he goes, Apple, Roblox, and Tesla, Dad. Yeah. And he, I think at the time, was 5 years old or something. So, I mean, there is nothing wrong, because they interact with this stuff. They see it. They know it. They say whether they like it or not. But when I say, I think people think they have to know everything. Mm. And it's a huge difference between trying to know everything versus just starting. Start small, from little things, big things grow.
Yeah, beautifully put. I mean, that's why you have the book, because that's a fantastic way to start that journey. It's really one step at a time, and then kind of grow that journey over that period. Danielle, you've been a wealth of knowledge, and I know that you know, you can go really deep dive into this, but we know that people listening in are wanting to start their journey with this and take that back to the conversations at the table. You've mentioned in your book two things: technical disruption and climate change. I think, like, my kids would really enjoy hearing about this and how that's impacting the world. Can you let us steal a bit of your insight so we can bring it home to our dinner table?
Okay. Technological change, that's pretty simple. You know, we will increasingly see the likes of generative AI impacting on the way we work. And we've already seen those kind of scary images out there of, you know, beautiful golden retriever or Labrador puppies in the snow, that it's all been generated AI. We joke in the office that how much longer before, you know, my avatar will be presenting on AusBiz as opposed to me. So there are real consequences of what's going on in that space. And NVIDIA is obviously the poster child of that change, but there are hundreds of other companies. Every company is starting to take the artificial intelligence, which has been around for ages, but now it's more thinking, generative AI to produce outcomes. So technology cuts across so many different aspects of our lives. That's just the easiest one to isolate at the moment. And that's where it intersects with climate change. There's two ways that I kind of look at it. You either invest in it, as in you can invest positively, impact investing in companies that are trying to make a difference, or you can invest in decarbonization themes. There's multiple different ways to do it. But the other side of the coin is realizing that climate change will have a material impact on pretty much every company. I don't think investors have got their head around that one yet, because climate change impacts on everything, the way we live, work, etc. So I think investors need to adjust for climate risk in their portfolios. I, by way, don't invest in insurance companies, only because I just, you know, it's just, I just think there's too much risk sitting in there with an extreme weather event and their earnings get hit. But equally so, when you invest for positive change, if you want to invest in electric vehicles, well, that worked up until the cycle turned recently, and currently it's not working. So there's different ways to cut that cake. And I would say that some companies are actively trying to do a lot of positive stuff in terms of embedding ESG principles, environmental social governance principles, into their companies, and also companies that are directly investing for positive change. So most great companies are starting to embrace all of these things more readily. Then there is certainly a cohort of investors that just go, well, I just want to invest in my oil, gas, coal companies. And I'm not saying, you know, there's anything necessarily wrong with that. And they go, well, I'm just going to make lots of money out of it, and so be it. So it's a very personal decision, Dawn, because overlaying a moral judgment when it comes to share investing is very personal. What is somebody's devil is another body, somebody else's, oh, well, I don't mind, by way of example. And so I would say on those fronts, just be aware that climate risk is real when you are investing. And when you're investing for companies to make money out of climate change, or to invest in a company that's investing to create positive change, you just need to look at it in the context of it's a big long-term secular thing, but sometimes there are intermittent cycles which can cause a lot of volatility in the company's earnings and share prices.
Thank you for that, Danielle. I'm going to be thinking about how I make that into conversation this evening, because
that's a tricky one.
Yes, I might have to replay this and go, okay, I'm just going to take some of your words, Danielle, and talk to my kids. And I think we talk about climate change and ethical considerations in our household, but I must admit that I've not really gone far in how that could impact companies. I've kind of kept it at a very brief, yeah, this is sort of what we believe in. And like you said, there's a judgment placed on maybe how we approach that, but not really explaining why they might impact particular companies. So that's given me food for thought, definitely as a parent, to maybe just expand those conversations a bit more, because, you know, it's important that the kids know stuff like that when it comes to investing. And maybe they might be challenging us a bit more in the future about our choices around where we put our money in, you know, so that creates for a really robust relationship.
Oh, don't worry, Dawn, you're going to be challenged on so many levels. I put that one at the lower end of the curve.
Yes, I suppose being challenged on that maybe feels like, okay, they're growing their knowledge journey. Being challenged about, you know, what they can take in their lunchbox is a bit of a difference. It's less or satisfying.
Or can they go to Tay Tay?
Yes. There's a whole other thing, Danielle. I'll be like, oh, I don't know if that's where we can invest our household funds in that passion project. Yeah. Danielle, I really do appreciate the time you've given us, because we are really so lucky to have you on the Start Well podcast. And I'm looking forward to actually hearing the experience from our community in the Start Well group about how they've gone with your book. And that's going to kick off a lot more journeys, so people can actually start investing and looking more long-term. And I hope a lot more kids get on that journey as well. earlier. Thanks so much.
Pleasure, Dawn. Well, thank you so much. I feel very honored to have been asked. So thank you for including me.
Thanks, Danielle. In the spirit of reconciliation, I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connection to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Start Well and investing in the financial empowerment of young people. Please refer to the show notes for resources and links discussed in this episode. Subscribe now to get notified of the latest episodes as they drop weekly. And visit us on the Wealth Designers Start Well page for further resources to continue your knowledge journey.